Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, sweetheart. I missed you last week. Okay.
I did too.
Yeah, I think we all did. Good morning, everyone. My name is Jeffrey Swartz. I am a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. I'm here together with my compatriot, Brendan Berry, who, believe it or not, is a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. It's amazing how that works, isn't it? Just flabbergast me all the coincidences that occur. I got lost here. Okay. I got to start all over again. No, I don't have to start all over again. Good morning, Marilyn. The situation is that I have to give the disclaimer. I'm kind of flabbergasted at the moment. I kind of screwed myself up here. I want to say that the opinions and the things that are said by Brendan and myself are our opinions and our opinions alone, except for the ones that we agree on, which is just about everything. But to the same extent, they are not the opinions of the administration, necessarily the opinions of the administration and or the faculty of WMU Cooley Law School, either individually or at large. And so I say at this point, good morning to Brendan.
Hi, and Jeffrey. How are you doing?
Not really great, as you can probably tell. Yeah. And the voice is a dead giveaway, I think. Hezzy, who is our patron, okay, and is back. And we're very happy that he is back and he is doing well. Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning, both of you. Thank you very much. I'm thrilled.
You're welcome.
Well, this is a propitious day. My goodness.
The real problem here is that I'm sitting in my home and I am restricted to being in my home because I went out to Colorado last week to a bucket list thing. I took my grandson for his first skiing lesson, which was an important thing for me. It's just a bucket list thing that I had. And in the process of flying probably to Colorado, I managed to be in airports and airplanes, which is the worst place you can be, unless you are a big fan of COVID, in which case, you know, you want to fly in as many as you possibly can. And I picked up COVID for the second time. Came back testing positive for COVID. So I'm sitting here in my home, locked up in here for probably another couple, 3 days until the Paxlovid does what it's supposed to do, which is take the virus out of my system. So I'm kind of screwed up here. I'm kind of in a fog, to say the less, the least. The less? Okay, the less. Okay. I am really screwed up. Okay, but
that's
I'm
all right.
Getting better. I'm getting better. It's the lack of sleep is what it really is. So, so that's kind of the way it is. How you doing, Bren? You doing okay?
I'm not feeling great either, and I'm in a very grumpy mood. That's how I'm doing.
I know.
Are you glad you asked?
I know. I know you're in a grumpy mood. Okay, so that
I never heard you in a grumpy mood. You're always so balanced.
Oh,
I don't get it. What's happened here?
It's a sight to behold, Hezzy, trust me. I'm always, people are used to that, okay?
Yeah.
So be that as it may. really. No, everybody knows that, or should know, that Brendan and I spend some time together on the telephone every Tuesday morning preparing for what we're going to talk about in this class. And somehow our preparation for today somehow devolved into a conversation about a matter that's before the faculty, which, by the way, Brendan is the chairman of our faculty conference. And it devolved into that. And Brendan is just like so on edge about this. It's true. That if I voiced anything that did not comport, okay,
yeah.
He was ready to do battle. Okay, it was like the movie Michael. Okay, you know, with John Travolta, where he sees a battle. Okay, He's ready to do battle because that's what Michael did, okay?
Okay. I know. My motto is from Seinfeld. Serenity now. Serenity. I just got to write that across my forehead. Serenity now.
Yeah, sure. That's going to work.
Oh, God.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, and I don't want to be where Brendan is right now. I got to be honest. Because, you know, our faculty is, although we all like each other, we are divided on a lot of stuff. And because of that, the issue, and we don't need to go into what the issue is, but the issue that's before the faculty right now is of such import to the school. And there are so many different opinions, and everybody's protecting their own personal turf, okay, that Brendan is sitting there, and there, it's hard for him to find somebody that's actually on all fours with him. And it's, okay. And
or with each other.
That's true. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes I think he argues with himself in the middle of the night. I don't know. It's just, you know, it's one of those.
That's why my motto is serenity now. I need some sleep. Okay.
Okay. I need sleep too. Okay. Right, so, right. Okay. But that's, nobody really cares about that.
Right.
Okay. They don't care about our problems.
No.
We start out, either, now that we've had a good laugh about poor Brendan's problems, we start out each, and I talked him into doing that job, by the way, so it's my fault. It is my fault. I'll accept that everything's my fault. I've learned that too.
He's got big shoulders. That's why it's on your back.
Now you know why, my health has gone down because everything, I'm carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders. When they say, I don't know if you ever use this app called Waze when you drive a car. You don't drive a car.
Yes,
but people,
absolutely.
Okay. So, when you go down the road, somewhere along the line, the thing says, careful. Automobile on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, that poor guy carrying his car on his shoulder down the road? Seriously? Okay.
Oh, God.
I just got to react that way because, like the weight of the world. All right, let's get off of this stuff. Let's talk about something.
Well, now that you mentioned the Waze app, I got a problem with that, which is the way the person says caution always scares the hell out of me. And I've almost had a few accidents because, right? Can't that app be calm?
No. And it can't be polite either.
Right.
I don't have a guy. I got a woman voice. And she's very, very bossy. Turn right. Okay. Who are you telling me what to do? Okay, I'm looking for suggestions, not direction, okay?
Right. Oh, God.
You know what the problem with, the problem with Waze is that they have an inability to translate from Hebrew to English, and that's the problem.
Everybody has a problem translating from Hebrew to English. Come on, Ezzy.
Yes, it's going in the wrong direction. That's the problem.
Be that as it may. Okay, be that as it may. All right, moving on from the ways. You know, I'm sure that we're going to be real popular with them. Maybe we'll even get a letter. We start out the show.
At least I can write in Hebrew, so it's not a problem.
Okay. We used to start this show out with a segment called What Do You Really Think? I think we just got done with that. Okay. But we used to do that, so let's try. We usually start out with a, what do you really think on something that's happening to the world, not to us in particular. I have one that I think that unfortunately people do not see the danger, the unbelievable danger to our way of life. In this particular issue, I've been screaming and yelling fascist, fascist, fascist now for the last 2 years. And I have been becoming overwhelmingly concerned over some of the things that are happening, in particular in some of the states who, thanks to our Supreme Court, have become brazen in the things that they do. They feel unleashed. And in particular in the South, they feel unleashed. I count the Deep South as being Florida now. I consider Florida part of the Deep South. It is no longer the purple or slightly bluish state that it had been for decades. It is the Deep South. Do not in any way, shape, or form fool yourself. Democrats and liberals who live in this area, who live down in Miami, who live in West Palm Beach, who live in Tampa, that you are living in a blue state or you're living in a purple state. This is a deeply red, deep South state now. And as a result of which, you had last year reelected a guy who clearly had fascist tendencies and made it clear that he had fascist tendencies. And you have empowered him. You have continued to give him a legislature for which Democrats are just occupying seats, because it's that overwhelming in both houses of the legislature. And you have legislators from the Republican Party who clearly in this state do whatever they are told to do by the guy sitting in the governor's chair. And it's been that way for a while, but it's worse now than it ever was before. The sense of an independent legislature does not exist in the state of Florida. It just doesn't. And anybody who believes that it does is just wrong. And the idea that they now want the state to take over local governments because local governments have a tendency to fight back has become the object of their next move towards consolidating power in one person who sits in the governor's chair to control everything that happens in a state. A man who wants to be president of the United States, by the way. And he wants to do the same thing to the entire country. The latest thing that Governor DeFuro-Santis is doing is, in his last term, he created what was known as the State Guard. Now, there are state guards all over this country, but they're supposedly like auxiliary National Guardsmen. They are trained to help the National Guard do certain things so the National Guard can do the more complicated and dangerous things. And when we start talking about when the National Guard's called in for policing or when the National Guard's called in for disaster relief. The support personnel are these state guardsmen, and there's usually a couple, 300 of them. He formed the state guard for the state of Florida, kind of in the keeping of what most of the other states have, a couple, 300 people, a very low budget. They're called up to help when they're needed, and that's all they do. DeSantis has changed the dynamic. He has asked in next year's budget for the legislature to, instead of $10 million to support these state guardsmen, you know, going out and finding them and giving them some remuneration when they're called up, he wants $98 million for his state guard. He wants to raise the number of people tenfold from 150 to 50. 1,500. He wants to give them police powers. He wants to give them badges. Badges? We don't need no stinking badges. He wants to give them badges. He wants to make them his own private police force, controlled only by him. no oversight by any agency, commission, or anything else. He controls them. He will control $98 million to be spent. And what is he going to spend it on? He wants his own private Gestapo. Don't think about it in any other way. He doesn't like something, he's going to stick his guard on somebody or something. Ron DeSantis is the first dictator in the history of the United States. The difference is he's just a dictator of a state. But he wants to take it to Washington. And this is who Fox News thinks should be the next president of the United States. This is dangerous stuff. This is Ron DeSantis' private brown shirt. My attitude is, all you old people who are living in Florida because it's warm and you're living on your retirement incomes, get the hell out as soon as you possibly can. Turn this state back over to the people who want it to be a fascist state. Isolate this state. Get out. It's one of the reasons why I want to get out. I'm one of the others. I'm Jewish. I'm one of the others. Will Ron DeSantis use Jewish people to get contributions? Will he use Jewish people to run banks and to run businesses for him? Sure. Just like another guy I know from the 30s. But when our usefulness is over, we will become one of the others. Because Ron DeSantis is an evangelical Christian who believes that God created him on the eighth day. This has to end. And if it doesn't, it will be the end of our way of life. It's not a conspiracy, people. Conspiracies are you make up things that happen or are going to happen. It is already happening. And if you don't know it, you got blinders on. Take them off. See the world. And that's what I really think today.
Yeah.
And I'm in a bad mood.
That makes two of us. I hope Hezzy is feeling buoyant.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Good.
Well, you're taking out all the wrath for me, so I'm good.
Good. All right. Oh, man. Well, as long as we're talking about Ron DeSantis and the other, and that's something that people really, when you talk about taking the blinders off, people really have to be aware of what that means historically and how that is used. And I'm talking about the othering of certain groups of people. This has been, I mean, anybody, if you have an eighth grade understanding of history, it's pretty obvious. And unfortunately, in human history, when you talk about nation building and tribalism, one of the, you know, most often used techniques, and it's very consciously used by would-be autocrats, is to create enemies. So there's no driver of human behavior like fear. If you can get humans to be afraid of something, really deathly afraid of something, if you can trigger their fight or flight response, then you've got them under your control. And one of the ways you do that is to give them enemies to be afraid of. And we, you know, I think probably most humans have had this experience, right? Even if it's just being a sports fan or something like that. You gotta give people to get their passions aroused. You know, you gotta give them somebody to be afraid of and somebody to hate. And I've done some reading about this. A lot of scholars say it's you know, a really good autocrat, if you will, somebody who knows how to do it, is going to give people external and internal, right? That there are going to be groups from outside your tribe who are a threat to your tribe, and then you're also going to give people forces within that they're supposed to be afraid of. And that's why people need to be really suspicious. There's a big difference between being scared or concerned about a phenomenon that really is a threat. So, for example, climate change and the warming planet, right? That's an issue. It's not a group of people. So you're not fear-mongering when you say, look, this is something we need to be concerned about and something that we need to tackle. But that's not othering. When a leader stops talking to you about issues and phenomena that we need to be concerned about and starts talking to you about groups we need to be scared of, especially groups from within our own society, now you know that you're being manipulated by a would-be autocrat. And I wish more people understood that. I say it all the time. You want to talk to me about what issues I should be concerned about? Go ahead. You start talking to me as you're a politician and you start telling me what groups I'm supposed to be scared of. I am running in the other direction as fast as I can from you. Now, Ron DeSantis, maybe it will be Jewish people someday, right, who will be his target du jour. But right now it's the LGBTQ community that is his target. He wants Floridians to be scared of gay people. He wants gay people to know that they are out. They're in the out group. They're not in the in group. And to that end, he's been promoting what we call the don't say gay approach in the state of Florida, which is that up until this point, he's proposed and the state board of education has required, and the state legislature, of course, is on board, that nothing about sexual orientation or gender identity is to be discussed with children, and I think currently it's up through third grade. And, of course, we were told, this is another thing they do, right? They tell you, well, don't worry about it. This is just, you know, that's just an age thing. The kids that young, you know, they're not old enough to understand it yet, and so, you know, that we just don't want them to be involved in all that. Well, that of course, was a lie. It was not about age at all. It's about othering people who are gay or transgender. The state is now proposing, in case anybody thought that it really was about age, you can banish that thought now. Because now the state is proposing, Republicans, of course, that rule be extended all the way through high school, that there may be no instruction in Florida schools about sexual orientation or gender identity, and that any teacher who does discuss that with students can lose their teaching license. You talk about dangerous, and that's something that's kind of a theme, Jeff, and running through your discussion earlier.
Right.
This is dangerous to the point of risking life. There is no group of teenagers more prone to suicide than gay teenagers. And the reason gay teenagers are so prone to hang themselves or otherwise kill themselves is that they are taught from a young age that a key component of who they are that is not changeable, that it is a sin, that it is awful, that it is the worst thing a person can be, that it is a reflection of something bad and inferior about you. And when you do that to a child, you are setting them up for emotional catastrophe. That is what Ron DeSantis and his Republicans in Florida are consciously doing to gay young people in this state. They're sending an unmistakable message. You shall not even be mentioned in our schools. You do not exist. You are the other. And to the extent that we do talk about you at all, we're going to call you groomers and suggest that you're all pedophiles. This, I'm not going to use the language I want to use right now.
Yeah.
You said this has to stop. This has to stop. I agree.
It is without any question. It is isolating. It is a target. The truth of the matter is that he doesn't care if you're scared or not. What he wants you to understand is they're not one of us. You don't really, I mean, I tell you things to make you afraid. I give you an excuse to hate. And he needs people to hate others, the others. And that's what it's all about. I don't think that 90% of the people who parrot this grooming allegation really are afraid that children are being groomed. I don't think they really believe that. They say they believe it. But what this is a license to hate someone who's different. And hate, in my opinion, hate is one of the greatest tools that autocrats use. To hate the other. To solidify behind me because I lead your hate. I give you license to hate. I give you the ability to punish. I empower you. And there is no question that what DeSantis and others are trying to do is empower Christians to assert themselves, to control all of the others because white Christians are superior to them. That's what they believe. And the worst part about this is that most white Christians don't believe this, but to the same extent, they ignore it. They don't stand up for what they supposedly believe in. They don't get involved. They talk yakety, 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 yak. But when the time comes, they pull the lever for Ron DeSantis. And people like him, which makes them complicit. The worst part for me are the Jews who back up Ron DeSantis, who excuse supporting Donald Trump because all they think about, and this is a sad thing to say, is they worry about their dollars and they worry about their material things, and they don't want to lose it by standing up. And in all honesty, that's how 6 million died in Europe. It'll be okay. We can control it. It won't get worse. And all it did was get worse. When you tolerate the beginning, it emboldens people. Right now, just like with the environment, our political environment is on a tipping point. Ron DeSantis is the focus of it right now. I believe that to be true. But that doesn't make him alone. We still got to deal with Donald and what he has wrought upon this nation. The Constitution today is wounded. It is in danger. The Constitution today is on the border of a couple more wounds of becoming in critical condition if it's not already there. The Constitution in many fascist countries end up being destroyed by the very people who are supposed to protect it. I'm talking about courts. I'm talking about Supreme Courts. Because they are put there by the people who want to destroy it, and they are devotees of that thought process. And we have a court like that right now. Everything that many of us grew up with is on its way to destruction. And Florida's just the opening salvo. That's why Charles Koch, I think he's the one that's still alive. Charles is one of the Koch brothers died. Charles Koch likes Ron DeSantis. Because he was raised in a home with a father who was one of the founding members of the John Birch Society, the incredibly ultra-conservative right-wing organization established in the 1950s. He does not believe, nor did his brother believe, in democracy. His brother ran for Congress, and when he lost, he realized, I can't destroy the federal government from the top down. I have to destroy it from the bottom up. And that's exactly what the Koch brothers have been doing, trying to destroy democracy. They believe in an aristocracy, excuse me, an aristocracy of sorts, an oligarchy. There are the rich people and there are all the other people who just work for the rich people to make them richer. That's what the Koch brothers believed in, and Charles Koch still believes in. So that's why they like Ron DeSantis. That's why they didn't invite Donald. They invited Ron to their little get-together a couple of weeks ago, which is why Ron didn't show up at CPAC, because he knows CPAC is nothing but a rally for Donald Trump. So he didn't go. I'm not going to go there and get booed. We are in incredibly dangerous times, and no one wants to talk about it. The press certainly doesn't talk. Well, they kind of talk about it, but they don't call it for what it is. They just, even the New York Times, will not call this what it is, fascism. It's like a dirty word. It's like one of those eight words you can't say on the radio. I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I'm hurting people's feelings. I'm sorry if you're getting angry because I'm not one of those people. Well, you are one of those people if you're not doing something about it. I don't want to hear you're not one of those people. I'm not a member of the party. But yeah, okay, but you support it. So what makes you different than being a member? Not everybody was a fascist. Yeah, okay. But you took everything they gave you. You followed what they told you to do. You voted for them when you were allowed to vote. I don't want to hear it anymore. You just have to recognize who you are and what you're doing. And understand if you're going to preserve a country for your children, you have to put some skin in the game. Now, I'm going to say this. Ron, if you pass the law that says I have to register when I talk about you, I'll send you a note, let you know where I live, and I'll wait for the knock on the door because I'm not going to register. And I will talk about you incessantly. You are my project du jour. And I will fight you in every way I possibly can. I might ship everything I own offshore so you can't get your hands on it, but I will fight you. Hmm. Are we done talking about Ron for today?
Yeah. Oh, there's much more we could say, I'm sure.
We could spend, we have spent 55 minutes talking about Ron DeSantis. I mean, 35 minutes. We got 20 minutes to cover everything else that we're going to talk about. So let's pick the most important subject that we have to talk about, because that's going to kill the hour. Okay? So let's go down the list. Do we talk about Donald? Do we talk about the school shooting? Do we talk about the new Georgia law?
Let's talk about the school shooting, because you mentioned it only a week ago, and I guess somebody must have heard about it.
Okay.
Because the president is even saying, hey, maybe we should do something.
Yeah, well, he's
the woman
that
just killed all these kids.
He was actually the author of the 1994 crime bill outlawing assault weapons.
Yeah.
So he's been doing stuff for almost 30 years now. I do want to point out one thing just for all of our Jewish and Israeli fans. Guess who's going to Israel to support Netanyahu?
Who?
Ron DeSantis.
You're kidding me.
And that tells you everything you want to know about Bibi Netanyahu. I have been a not fan of his for almost the entirety of his career. He has been and always be an authoritarian. And just simply put, his backing off temporarily on his changes, fundamental changes to the democracy in Israel, was just trying to buy time and get the people off the streets.
Mm-hmm.
They need to stay on the streets and demand his resignation. Again. They can't stop now. They've got him on the ropes, and they have to finish the job. Or 3 or 4 months from now, all of those changes will take effect. He will have bought the time he needed. He gave them nothing last night. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got Ron DeSantis coming there talking about what a great job he's doing. And that tells you everything you need to know about Bibi Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder why I stopped giving money to Israel. Sorry about that, Hezzy. I know that probably disturbs you.
Well, the whole situation is very, very disturbing. I don't know how we got here.
Well, you got there.
I really don't know how we got here.
For years. You got there because BB's been doing it for years, Hezzy. Years. It has been his goal all along. He thinks that Israel should be renamed Netanyahu.
Yeah.
That's how big his ego is. But we'll talk about that another day, because he's going to be around a while, and so is Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to do you want to talk about guns, Brendan?
Yeah, can we just rerun our show from a few weeks ago?
We could do that.
Just play that back.
Yeah, I suppose.
The point being, how often, you know, I mean, it's the – just another day in the United States. You know, you don't want to, if you don't want to get shot in the United States, stay home and use Instacart. You know, if you walk outside, I said this the last time this happened. This time it was in a private Christian school. There's nowhere. There's nowhere in the United States where you're literally nowhere where you're safe. You're not safe in a grocery store. You're not safe in a movie theater. You're not safe, obviously, in a school. You're not safe in a church or a synagogue or a mosque. You know, it's a good thing I'm an
introvert. How did we get here? I don't understand. I don't understand how we got to this point. We never used to pick up a gun 20 years ago.
Yeah.
At least I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
It's called politics. It's called the power of the gun manufacturers. It was the rise in crime during the 80s and 90s It was the destruction of the middle class that left a whole class of people with very little of their own and very little power. And their way they could assert power is by putting a gun in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
It was anger with the federal government. It was anger with state governments. It was, in some cases, fear of police. It was the failure, and I mean this very succinctly. If I'm going to blame anyone for where we are right now, if I can point to a person or a group of people, I will point to George Bush and the Republican Congress of 2005 that refused to extend the assault weapons ban from the 1994 crime bill, which was during the Clinton administration, and it was, in fact, Joe Biden who proposed the assault weapons ban. It should be noted that although mass shootings were not a problem before 1994, between 1995, when the assault weapons ban took place, and 2005, there was one, just one mass shooting that involved an AR-15. In 2007, the onslaught began. And with each year, it has gotten worse. From five or six during a year to five or six every week. That's what's happened. So George Bush sitting there doing your paintings and enjoying your resurrection as somebody that's important and that people listen to, because we don't talk about Iraq. We don't talk about the destruction of the economy. We don't talk about any of those things. You're some sort of statesman. We are where we are because of you. All you had to do is tell the Republican Congress to extend the assault weapons ban for another 10 years. But you weren't going to do that. So I blame you. And I don't want to hear your justifications. I blame you. And I blame the Republican Party, and I blame the manufacturers. By the way, I don't blame the NRA. They're just a front for the manufacturers. 90% of the money that goes into the coffers of the NRA are not gun owners. They are gun manufacturers. And the gun owners who belong have become their tool. George, are you listening? Please don't fall off the couch again if I say this. You're to blame. You are to blame. Wholly and completely and solely to blame. How about them apples?
You know, it's funny. I'm such a political idiot that I thought after the George W. Bush administration, with the mess that he left behind, two wars that were not finished and not paid for, one of which was a complete disaster, an economy that had completely collapsed, and a loss in real estate value that affected everybody and the middle class, including myself. Who took a six-figure bath on the house that I once owned. I said to myself, Americans will never, and this, again, I'm admitting to being an idiot when I said this, I don't think Americans will ever put another Republican in the White House. I don't know how they could. You'd have to have the political memory of a goldfish to keep putting Republicans back in the White House and then keep electing Democrats to clean up the mess and then blaming the Democrats when they can't get it done fast enough. But I was wrong on steroids about that. Not only did Americans put another Republican in the White House, but they've made it Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I say it all the time. Where's the bottom? Where's the bottom? Oh, my God. But, yeah, George Bush was an absolute, unmitigated, by any objective standard, disaster of a president. And you're correct. He's also responsible for resurrecting mass shootings on this scale in the United States. So add that to the list of his achievements. Go ahead.
No, you know what's funny about that, and I don't mean funny, ha-ha, but funny about it, is that when George Bush left office, he was compared to Warren Harding for being the worst president of the United States ever. I mean, he had jumped to number two. I think it was Millard Fillmore who was number two before that. Okay. And he jumped to number two. And then all of a sudden there was this big debate. And then I think a lot of people decided that Warren Harding was just a useful idiot. He wasn't terrible. He was just a useful idiot. And so they made, and George was making decisions. So George leaped over and was pretty equal. Then along came Donald Trump, and you'd see along this, you know, you'd see online and you'd see signs that said, with a picture of George Bush, that said, "You missed me yet? I will never miss you. To God, I will never, ever, ever. I don't care how many pieces of candy you pass to Michelle Obama at a funeral. I don't care. I will never forgive you." And I know that sounds very un-Jewish, by the way, because you are supposed to be forgiving. You know, like on Yom Kippur, someone calls up and tells you a bad thing they did, and please forgive me, you do it, because you need to get forgiveness from man before you get forgiveness from God. If you need forgiveness from man before God forgives you, George, you're never going to make it to the pearly gates, because I will never, ever forgive you. Ever. I don't hate you. I just won't forgive you. And I won't forget either. So much of what's wrong with this country was because of him. That 2008 recession and all the loss of that wealth and jobs and everything that happened, what do you think unleashed the far right? Their feeling that they were losing their country. We saw the same phenomena during the Depression. And what happened in 2008 did not have to happen. What happened from 2000 to 2008 and the aftermath over the next 4 years, when Obama had to fix so much of it, was all him. It was all his belief that he was smart enough to be president of the United States. He wasn't. He was never going to be. And then he picks Cheney. And he allows the Republican Party to tell him what to do. Guys like Karl Rove. "I won't forgive you. You should have stayed in Texas. I'm sorry your father wanted retribution against Bill Clinton. And he couldn't get your brother Jeb a governorship in 1996, that would have set him up for 2000. So it had to fall on you because daddy was getting old." Not that I'm a big Jeb fan. I think he's a nice guy. I know him. He's a nice guy, but politically, I couldn't be farther away from him, I just know the things that he did. But to the same extent, he at least understood how government worked. And he would have made his own decisions. We would have had to live with them, but they wouldn't have been as bad as George's. All because they had to get retribution on the Democrats for making Daddy a one-term president. And then start a war because Saddam Hussein tried to say, well, had a conspiracy to kill your father, so I'm going to wipe out his country. Probably the biggest geopolitical mistake this country has ever made. I can't forgive you, George. Sorry. Not sorry. How did we get on George Bush? Oh, that's my fault. That was my fault.
It is an interesting point. I mean, and, you know, you mentioned, you know, people don't remember, and that's the problem. I mean, it's like, this wasn't ancient history.
No.
You know, and yet that it's a sad state of affairs that we have now had a president who was so utterly awful in every way that by comparison, he did make George Bush look like a statesman. And yet here we are. Trump is he's still leading the way in the Republic. So maybe we should end off by talking about his problems. What's new in the Trump world?
David. Well, one important bad thing happened to Trump yesterday. David Pecker. Who is the head of AMI, is it AMI or AIM? AMI, which is a publishing group that used to have the National Enquirer. I don't think they publish the National Enquirer anymore because inquiring people didn't want to know anymore. He, just as a little background, David Pecker, who headed up the National Enquirer, had a deal going with Donald Trump that every time there was a threat by anybody that they were going to publish something bad about him that he thought was really bad for him, he would go to David Pecker and say, I want you to catch that story, and then I want you to kill it. In other words, Pecker would go to them and say, I'll give you $150,000 or $100,000 for an exclusive on this story. And he'd pay the money. That's called the catch. And then he would kill the story by saying, I have an exclusive right to this story. We're not going to publish it, but you can't go to anybody else to publish it. You can't write a book. You can't do this. You can't do that because I have exclusive rights to this story. You sold the story to me. And then Donald, through his means of laundering money in certain ways, would pay David Pecker back. And Pecker would put all this stuff in a big vault. Now, that was the deal. However, for some reason, Pecker did not want to get involved with Stormy Daniels. Don't know why, but he didn't want to. But he knows the process, and he knows Michael Cohen, and he knows how Michael does things, and he basically taught Michael how to capture a story or how to buy people off. If nothing else, when Donald says, I don't launder money and I don't pay people off to kill a story, David Pecker is going to take the stand and say, well, what about this one and this one and this one? What about McDougal? What about a few others? Okay. And he's got the goods. He's got the repayment. He's got the goods. But what Donald did do is he would put it through different places to get the money to David Pecker so that it essentially didn't come from him. And Michael Cohen was one of the facilitators of this stuff. So he takes a stand, and this is what we call similar transaction or course of conduct. So when Donald says, I don't do things like that, in walks David Pecker and says, you do it all the time, schmuck. What the hell are you talking about? It was a bad day for Donald Trump yesterday. The real hole in all of this is that Donald's going to claim it wasn't a campaign contribution because he knows that's what makes this a felony. But unfortunately, he said things that made it clear that it was. And Michael Cohen has the goods. He says Michael did this all on his own. He borrowed money on his house, and he did this as a because he believes in me. Really? And amazingly enough, when you sent him all of those attorney's fees, he used it to pay off the loan. But that wasn't what the money was sent to him for, right? To pay him back? He had a bad day yesterday. But he may not be having such a bad day in Georgia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Brendan?
Yeah, that's another thing that's going on is down in Georgia, they've passed a law. We were kind of researching this morning, creating a commission that empowers a commission at the state level to discipline local prosecutors who they deem to be soft on crime or not sufficiently enforcing certain criminal laws.
Right.
There's a big problem with passing, apparently the governor is about to sign that into law, with giving Republicans any ability to create mischief with local prosecutors at the same time that Fannie Willis, the DA in Fulton County in Atlanta, is investigating Donald Trump. As we discussed this morning, on the face of it, it doesn't look like this commission can really target her because it's supposed to be targeting people for failing to enforce law. But like I said, I mean, for Republicans to be doing this power grab over local prosecutors, which they've done in many states, at the same time that one of those local prosecutors is looking at Trump's attempt to steal the election in Georgia, the word I'll repeat is mischief. You can't trust them as far as you can throw them to use that power in an appropriate way. So we'll see what impact, if any, that has. But the upshot, if I'm Fannie Willis, man, I'm going to start getting my act together and get this thing done, because Republicans at the state level are going to come for you. And I don't know why she's still sitting on an indictment. She's already had a special grand jury impaneled. They've already done their report. She's got all the tape recordings that she needs to prosecute this case. So it's beyond me why prosecutors are not all over that. But
I personally think the real problem here is that she, for lack of a better way to put it, got too big for her britches. I think that she wanted to widen this investigation beyond where it needed to go. I think she started going after Mark Meadows. She started going after Lindsey Graham. She started going after others to make them part of a conspiracy, whether it was Rudy Giuliani or what's her name, the lawyer. The one that
Sidney Powell.
Sidney Powell, yes, Sidney Powell. I don't think she needed to widen it very far to get some of those people. I think she wants to create a conspiracy, and as a result of which, she slowed herself down. I think she has a fear of being first. She probably is afraid of the Republican backlash. But if you are who you claim you are, then you have to do your job. And I think it's time, forget the lawsuit that Donald filed to wipe out the report of the special grand jury, because that's not going anywhere. And it just gets converted into a motion to dismiss the indictment, which will never happen. And let's make Donald go to trial. and you have all the rulings that you need. Now, remember, all the rulings that you have on executive privilege and all that are in federal courts. That does not bind the state courts of Georgia. And you don't know what some judge is going to do to your case. But the fact of the matter is that it's time. It's time that he gets charged with all the felonies that you can possibly find out of with a chance of conviction out of the factual basis you have. You can name Lindsey Graham. If you don't want to bring him in, name him as an unindicted co-conspirator. You can name a number of people as unindicted co-conspirators and bring them in. Give them their use immunity and force them to testify. You have a target. It's time to pull the trigger. It really is. Don't leave Bragg out on his own. And that goes for you, Jack Smith, too. You got everything you need for Mar-a-Lago. You wouldn't be the first prosecutor to indict, but continue to investigate. I'd like to see something on January 6th. I don't think I'm ever going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're running out of time. Tick tock. Tick tock. But indicting him on Mar-a-Lago, you got him. You got everything you need. You made Cochran testify. That nailed Donald, because the first question is, when you drafted this affidavit, was it based on information you received from the former president of the United States, Donald Trump? And when his answer is yes, you've got him on subornation of perjury. You got him on all kinds, obstruction of justice, all kinds of felonies that he will not walk away from. And then he'll play his card and say, okay, I'll be a good little boy and stay in Mar-a-Lago and play golf. I won't say anything, and I'll withdraw from the president, my candidacy for president. I will not make contributions or raise money or run rallies. I will just sit there and quietly do nothing. Okay, that's the condition of your 10-year probation. By the time you're 86, I'm not going to worry about you. No early termination. But I know that's the card he's going to play. So let's get on the stick, people. Fanny, you're running out of time. Tick tock. Tick tock. Bragg, you've extended it long enough. Tick tock. You're looking weak here. You don't have any choice, Bragg, but to file charges after he's tried to intimidate you. If you don't file charges, it's because he intimidated you, and you are out. I hope you enjoy your one term as the prosecutor for Manhattan. Okay? So, that's how I address that issue.
From your lips, as they say, to God's ear. And I see we are 5 minutes into...
I taught you something. I actually taught you something, Brendan. I'm so proud.
Every day you teach me something I didn't know. What are you talking about?
Yeah, uh-huh. There you go. That was very complimentary, but untrue. Okay. Okay. Hezzy, we've gone over. We give you back your time. Okay?
Thank you.
And
what a pleasure.
We worry about you. Please take care of yourself.
I will. And my apology again. You know, for forgetting
yesterday. No apologies necessary.
Yep.
Okay, you take care of yourself.
Thanks so much.
Okay,
you
Brendan.
All right.
I guess I'll see you at the meeting on Thursday. Take care.
Yes.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Be well. Thanks, guys. Bye. Oh, how exciting. It never gets more exciting than listening to Jeff Swartz and Brendan Beery and Jeff Swartz. Literally a pleasure. All right, let's follow up on what was discussed today, and we'll follow up first looking at what went on in France and then looking at what went on in Israel. And I think it'll tie into what was spoken about today. The French government angered trade unions anew on Tuesday by abruptly rejecting their demands for a pause in pension reform plans to allow for a mediation period. Nearly 2 weeks after French President Emmanuel Macron forced an unpopular pension reform through Parliament, hundreds of thousands are expected to take part in a 10th day of strikes and protests across France. So let's look at the streets, or let's look to the streets for a 10th day of strikes on Tuesday against government plans to reform the pension system, of which a proposal to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 is among the most controversial. And public transport was disrupted and deliveries were halted across France as workers walked out on the job. Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne used Article 49-3, known as the nuclear option, to push the reforms through Parliament without a vote on March 16, and days later, the government narrowly survived two no-confidence votes. French President Emmanuel Macron insisted the proposed changes are needed to reform a moribund system, but some of the government's own experts have said that the pension system is in relatively good shape and would likely return to a balanced budget even without reforms. A previous nationwide mobilization last Thursday drew more than a million demonstrators, according to the Interior Ministry. The unions estimated participation much higher at more than 3 million. Hundreds of people were arrested that day in the most violent pension protest to date. So leftist opposition politicians urged Macron to negotiate. Opposition party leaders on the left were quick to criticize the government's refusal to pause reform plans to allow time for mediation, and the Macron government said last week that it was willing to talk to unions, but on other topics, not on pension reform. The government told us that it had an outstretched hand, but we are still looking for it, said the Socialist Party First Secretary Olivier Faure, adding, quote, we have a completely deaf and blind president who does not understand his country, end quote. Quote, France does not lead with a cudgel. Far left former presidential president Jean-Luc Mélenchon said of the government's refusal to take part in negotiations. Speaking on Tuesday from the Paris demonstration, he said even the majority of people who are against pension reform are now, quote, saying to themselves that all this is crazy, end quote. Former environmentalist presidential candidate Yannick Jadot urged compromise, saying the government must, quote, choose the option of appeasement, dialogue, reconciliation, end quote. Communist Party chief Fabien Roussel called on Macron to be open to compromise. Quote, President Emmanuel Macron, listen to the deputies of your majority and accept the outstretched hand of the unions. Well, the government rejects mediation offer from the unions. In an attempt to break the impasse on Tuesday, the moderate CFDT union chief, Laurent Berger, proposed mediation in an attempt to find a compromise. But the proposal was immediately dismissed by the government, quote, we do not necessarily need mediation, quote unquote, to talk to each other, said the government spokesman Olivier Véran. Berger announced the government's, quote, unacceptable, end quote, response from his position at the head of the Paris march. He did, however, receive some unexpected support from the centrist MoDem, the Mouvement Democrat, or the Democratic Movement Party, members of the ruling coalition. Quote, it's good to have one or two people seeking out dialogue and taking a step, MoDem chief Jean-Paul Mattei. Well, the French government angered trade unions anew on Tuesday by abruptly rejecting their demands for a pause in a pension reform plans to allow for a period of mediation, and protesters were back on the streets for a 10th day of mobilization amid fears the most peaceful march could devolve into a new wave of violence after violent clashes erupted last Thursday. That was reported from Paris by Catherine Noristron, France 24's reporter. So a large crowd marches through Paris in a 10th day of strike action against pension reforms. That's the final story. Garbage collection strike comes to an end. The CGT union has announced that the garbage collection strike will end as of Wednesday. Thousands of tons of trash have piled up on the streets of Paris and other cities after trash collectors went on strike against pension reform plans. Trash collectors and drivers are currently retire from 57 years of age, but under Macron's reform plan, they would face another 2 years of work. An early retirement is an option for those professions who face certain conditions, but garbage collectors say making them work longer would be unfair as their life expectancy is 12 to 17 years below the French average, according to the CTG union. So that's where we are. But there's also concern over police brutality. Hundreds of people were arrested in the previous mobilization on Thursday, the most violent pension protest to date, when the largely peaceful marches gave way to anger over the government's decision to bypass Parliament in forcing through the pension reform. Security forces fought running battles with protesters late into the night, even as firefighters raced to extinguish hundreds of blazes. Videos shared on social media showed police officers beating and pepper spraying protesters and even bystanders at close range. Even before Thursday's escalation, the rising violence had prompted many quarters to voice concern about the heavy-handed policing, including Amnesty International. France's own human rights ombudsman, Claire Hédron, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Association, Clément Boulle, and the Council of Europe. So the first clashes were reported. The first clashes between pension reform protesters and police were reported early on Tuesday afternoon in Nantes, where a bank was set on fire and a local administrative court was targeted, according to an Agence France Press journalist. And after a peaceful start to the protest, young protesters threw projectiles at police, who responded with tear gas. And so it goes. And so this is one of the problems that's taking place on an international basis, and it's very, very frightening, to say the least. So let's look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment as we move on here. Okay. One moment here. One second. Okay. Cover this because I think you'll find this important. Question is, when is a bank systemically important? Why do banks need to be rescued? And when are they actually systemically important? Plus, why is the dream of owning your own home an environmental nightmare? And how can those houses be heated more efficiently? Are mini houses a good alternative? So these are some of the questions at hand, and hopefully you'll find them interesting. I guess I must have misplaced the article on that, but we'll find out what's going on. This thing is really interesting. This comes from Deutsche Welle. Berlin is going to clarify gender equality rules for topless bathing. Seems that topless bathing was never officially banned in the German capital, but now the city's municipal pool operator has said all genders must be treated equally when it comes to appropriate attire. So when Lotte Mies went topless at an indoor swimming pool in the Berlin district of Karlsdorf last December, she was asked to either cover her chest or leave the pool. The 33-year-old activist had already called ahead to check with staff that she could go topless. It would not be a problem. But when she refused to cover up, the police were called and Mies was forced to leave. It was more than humiliating for me that day, and it really wasn't nice to be treated like a second-class citizen on the basis of my gender and not to be able to decide for myself how to present my own body, Mies told Deutsche Welle. I thought about it, and I came to the conclusion that, quote, no, I don't want to be ashamed of my breasts anymore. It's actually not in order. Mies told Deutsche Welle, this permanent sexualization that we are exposed to, and it's not just about breasts, I just don't want to accept it anymore. Well, Mies filed a complaint with the Ombudsman Office responsible for compliance with Berlin's Anti-Discrimination Act, a law that was introduced in the state of Berlin in June of 2020 and is the first of its kind in Germany. Well, the General Equal Treatment Act, which covers the whole of Germany, forbids discrimination in labor and civil law contexts. Berlin's Anti-Discrimination Act extends this existing law to guard against discrimination in the public sector. The Berliner Bäder Betriebe, the capital's municipal swimming pool operator, never had a gender-specific dress code, only a general rule mandating customary bathing attire for both men and women, which left it down to staff at each pool to interpret what this actually meant. Now, in response to the public outcry over Mies' case, the pool operator has issued a clarification to ensure that women can go topless at public pools just the same as men. Well, the question is whether it's equal rights for all Berliners. Well, the clarification simply states that, quote, swimming topless, end quote, is equally permissible for all persons and only the, quote, primary sexual organs need to be covered. The German government anti-discrimination agency classifies breasts, beards, and body hair as secondary sex characteristics. Primary sex characteristics are defined as those necessary for sexual reproduction, such as the penis, testicles, and vagina. Doris Liebscher, the head of the Ombudsman's office responsible for compliance with the Anti-Discrimination Act in Berlin, welcomed the clarification to the rules in the capital, saying that the decision, quote, establishes equal rights for all Berliners, whether male, female, or non-binary. Well, campaigners are calling for desexualization of upper body. This all comes from a similar case hit the headlines in the summer of 2021, when Gabriella Le Breton went topless at a water park with her five-year-old son in the Berlin district of Treptow-Köpenick. When Le Breton refused to cover her chest, the police were called and she was forced to leave the park. Le Breton decided to sue. In one of the first cases to be launched off the back of Berlin's Anti-Discrimination Act, she lost her case when the district court Landesgericht ruling that women's breasts are different from men's and can therefore be subject to different regulations. The Breton is currently in the process of appealing the decision at the Berlin Appellate Court Kammergericht. Well, unfortunately, this idea is exactly where the discrimination of the female chest starts, Leonie Thum, the lawyer representing Le Breton, advised Deutsche Welle. The assumption that the sexualization of the female chest is somehow rooted
in biology and therefore somehow mandatory, which isn't true. It's simply to overcome a social assumption that the law doesn't define as an adequate justification for discrimination of genders. Hume argued that the ruling essentially subverted what the anti-discrimination law is for, as if, quote, part of the public has an issue with something that is always enough reason to justify discrimination, end quote. After Le Breton was ordered to leave the water park in 2021, activists in Berlin founded the intersectional feminist alliance called Equal Breasts for All, Gleiche Brust für Alle, which campaigns for the desexualization of the upper body in a similar vein to the Free the Nipple campaign in the United States. Under the motto, no nipple is free until all nipples are free, end quote, quote, end quote, campaigners cycled topless through Berlin to protest the hypocrisy of denying women the right to go topless in a city covered with adverts depicting half-naked, sexualized, and unrealistic images of bodies. Well, the Free the Nipple campaign went mainstream in 2013 after the release of the film of the same name, using the hashtag Free the Nipple. Quote-unquote, campaigners have argued that women should be allowed to appear topless in public in the same way as men, including on social media platforms where images of women's breasts are regularly censored, from Renaissance paintings to photos of breastfeeding. Men don't have to hide their beards just because in puberty that signifies that they are ready to have sex, but for some reason with women's breasts that's the case. Said Toon, adding that men have biological markers that signal puberty in the same way that women do. The only difference, she said, is that they are not expected to hide them. Another often overlooked aspect of the rules around topless bathing is the right of transgender and non-binary people, said Toon. If you have a gender regulation based on two genders, that is binary. Then you will always discriminate against trans and non-binary people. There's no way around it, and that's what happens all the time. In August of 2021, a non-binary topless swimmer was ordered to leave a public swimming pool in the German city of Göttingen in Lower Saxony. And following a campaign by Equal Breasts for All, the municipal authority last year introduced a pilot project to allow topless bathing for all genders on Saturdays and Sundays at four of its pools, or Germany's nude bathing tradition. Germany is not known for having a prudish attitude towards nudity. Fully naked bathers can be seen on beaches and in parks, soaking in the sun, even in the most conservative parts of the country. In fact, the country has a long tradition of nude public bathing as part of the free body culture. Freikörper, commonly referred to as the FKK, a naturist movement that emerged in the late 19th century. In an interview with Playboy back in 2017, prominent left party politician Gregor Gysi from the former East Germany complained about the decline of free body culture, which he blamed on the pornographic gaze of men from the West. Since Berlin's municipal pool operator announced it would clarify its rules concerning topless bathing as a result of Lotte Miles, Mies's complaint. Mies has been subjected to a wave of misogynistic online abuse, ranging from derogatory comments about her appearance to rape threats. Most of them are the classic victim-perpetrator role reversal that I am somehow to blame if more women are raped now, Mies advised Deutsche Welle. Well, Germany still lags behind other European countries when it comes to implementing anti-discrimination legislation long since enshrined in European law, said Thun. I always thought it would be a straightforward process, that it would always develop to to a more equal, free society, and I think we are, but because of a lot of pushback, it's much slower than you would think, she said. Okay. Literally fascinating, to say the least, what's going on there. Bear with me a moment here. 1 second. Where is it? Now let's look at this. Ukraine update. Russia evidently has suffers tank losses in the Donetsk region. Russia has lost tanks in the town of Avdiivka due to tactically flawed assaults, according to British intelligence. Meanwhile, the first Challenger 2 tank has arrived in Ukraine, and Russia has suffered heavy losses in its assault in Avdiivka in the Donetsk region, the British Defense Ministry said today. Russia's 10th Tank Regiment has likely lost a large portion of its tanks while attempting to surround Avdiivka from the south, the British Defense Ministry said in its daily intelligence update. Well, the ministry said that the losses were likely due, quote, to tactically flawed frontal assaults, end quote, similar to Russia's failed attack on nearby Vuleda. The 10th Tank Regiment is part of Russia's 3rd Army Corps, which was formed last year after the invasion of Ukraine. Quote, numerous open-source accounts suggested that 3rd Army Corps has been particularly dogged by problems with ill discipline and poor morale, the British intelligence update had said. Quote, despite a likely period of training in Belarus, the formation still appears to display limited combat effectiveness. Well, Belarus hosts the nuclear weapons after years of unprecedented pressure from the West. Belarus's foreign ministry said it agreed to host tactical nuclear weapons in order to protect itself after years of unprecedented pressure from the West. The ministry added the move did not contravene international non-proliferation agreements. Russian President Vladimir Putin announced his intention to station weapons in neighboring Belarus last week, drawing condemnation from Ukraine and Western allies. NATO said that Western allies act with full respect for their international commitment and rejected Russian claims, saying they're only doing what the U.S. has done for many decades. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said that Belarus would face further sanctions over the plan. The United Kingdom and Poland are going to build temporary villages in Ukraine. The United Kingdom and Poland will build 2 major temporary villages in western and eastern Ukraine to provide housing to Ukrainians forced to flee the war, the United Kingdom government said in a statement. The United Kingdom announced up to £10 million, that's about $12 million, to build temporary shelters and provide energy supplies. The accommodation villages in Lvov in western Ukraine and Poltava in eastern Ukraine will offer accommodation for more than 700 Ukrainians, according to the statement. More than 17.6 million people are thought to be in humanitarian need in Ukraine, with more than 8 million having registered as refugees in Europe, the largest movement in Europe since World War II. President Zelensky visited Sumy in northern Ukraine, continuing his tour of Ukraine's frontline regions. He met officials and local people in 2 cities in the region which borders Russia. Sumy was partially occupied after Russia invaded Ukraine last year, but the Kremlin's forces withdrew from the region early in April. Ukrainians will live here, on their land, in their cities and villages, which we have to rebuild after the war. And I'm sure it will definitely happen, Zelensky said in his speech. He recalled the shelling of kindergarten in the region, noting that one of the cities he visited, Och, Pielka experienced heavy losses and brutal enemy strikes. British Challenger 2 tanks have arrived in Ukraine. It seems that Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov thanked the United Kingdom on Tuesday after the first Challenger 2 tank arrived in Ukraine. The UK pledged to send 14 of the main battle tanks to Ukraine in January. These fantastic machines will soon begin their constant missions or their combat missions, Reznikov said in a video hosted on social media. On Monday, Ukrainian forces in the United Kingdom completed their training to operate the Challenger 2. While Russia's oil sales to India doubled in the past year, Energy Minister Nikolai Shulginov said on Tuesday, Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said that energy exports were redirected to the markets of friendly countries after Moscow was hit by sanctions over the invasion of Ukraine. He said that energy revenues accounted for 42% of Russia's budget in 2022. Well, Russia test-fired anti-ship missiles in the Sea of Japan, Russia's defense ministry said on Tuesday. The Moskit supersonic cruise missiles were fired at a mock enemy warship around 100 kilometers, it's about 60 miles away. Japan did not lodge a complaint or a protest to Russia over the naval exercise because it was conducted in the Peter the Great Gulf near Vladivostok, away from Japan. On the whole, Japan is concerned about Russia's increasing military activities around the Japanese coast and watching them with great interest, said Tasuku Matsuki, the Japanese foreign ministry official in charge of Russia. Belarus wants nuclear weapons deal due to Western pressure. The foreign ministry in Belarus said today that the country was forced to host Russian nuclear weapons due to unprecedented, quote-unquote, pressure from the United States and other Western countries. Belarus is forced to respond to strengthen its own security and defense capability, the foreign ministry said. Minsk also reiterated the point made by Moscow that the deal in no way contradicts the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. And military cooperation between Belarus and Russia is carried out in strict accordance with international law, the ministry said. Well, the British government announced on Tuesday that it will work with Poland to build two temporary villages in Ukraine, which we had mentioned to you earlier. The city of Bakhmut has been under siege for months, and Deutsche Welle's Max Zander spoke to some of the soldiers holding the line. More than 20 foreign firms that fled Russia after the invasion of Ukraine relocated to Kazakhstan, authorities in Astana claimed, and that's it. So that's part of the story there. 1 second here now. One moment. Okay. And this is really very fascinating. I didn't think we had come to this point, but it has. Japan is holding evacuation drills amid the Taiwan invasion fear. It seems that remote islands of Japan's Okinawa Prefecture have begun evacuation drills amid worries that China could attack Taiwan. But experts doubt the effectiveness of such drills. Citing the threat from China's aggressive military expansion, Japan has dramatically transformed its defense posture since last year, beefing up its defense budget, strengthening defense capabilities, and deepening cooperation with key allies like the United States and the Philippines. Some of Japan's remote islands in the south are also enhancing their preparation for a potential military conflict across the Taiwan Strait. On March 18, Japan's Okinawa Prefecture called out its first simulated exercise that aims to evacuate around 100,000 residents from remote islands close to Taiwan. Officials are concerned about southern Japan being affected by a potential Chinese invasion of the stealth-ruled island, which China sees as part of its own territory. Both local and national authorities in Japan took part in the exercise, which was staged in several cities on the Tsushima Islands, about 360 kilometers, that's about 225 miles away from Taiwan. According to Japanese media, the drill simulated residents on smaller islands in the Okinawa Prefecture, first being taken to bigger islands like Ishigaki and Miyako, and then transferred to Okinawa's main island of Kyushu. Apart from the 120,000 local residents and tourists being evacuated based on the expertise of around 1.4 million people living on or around the prefecture's main island were asked to hide indoors. The authorities plan to extract people on civil aircraft and vessel, and the local government in Okinawa would cooperate with airline and ferry companies or other transportation providers to complete the task. Local authorities estimated that the entire evacuation effort could take 6 days. Well, the U.S. bases in Japan could become targets. Seems that while officials in Okinawa tried to downplay the correlation between the evacuation drills and the potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan, some experts say that the proximity of Okinawa to both Taiwan and China, as well as the fact that it hosts U.S. military bases, making the prefecture, quote, an obvious target of a Chinese attack, end quote. Quote, if China invades Taiwan, the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, may also attack U.S. military bases in Okinawa, which means Japan would be automatically dragged into a war with China, said Kyoko Hatakeyama, a professor at the University of Niigata Prefecture in Japan. Japan needs to avoid civilian deaths and casualties in Okinawa, and that's why evacuation drills are necessary or are becoming more important, she said. Last December, Japan's uppermost Yonaguni Islands also held an evacuation drill over potential ballistic missile strikes. Yonaguni is only 110 kilometers from Taiwan, about 60 some odd miles away. Well, the government apologizes over the J alert malfunction. Eleanor Hughes, a defense analyst at the Asia Group in the United States, advised that preparations are partly aimed at bolstering synergies on crisis management between authorities at different levels across Japan. One of the byproducts of these visible preparations is that it's more difficult for Japanese citizens to rule out the possibility that Japan can completely shield itself from feeling the reverberating effects of a contingency of war should one occur, she said. But some experts expressed doubt about the effectiveness of these evacuation drills. They also note that Japan's warning system, the J-Alert system, malfunctioned when North Korea fired ballistic missiles over Japan last October. Japan's chief cabinet secretary was forced to apologize to the public over the incident. The government. If the government's alert system seems to be dysfunctional, Japanese people may think, why should they be too troubled by the potential contingency, said Jeff Kingston, the director of Asian Studies at Temple University in Japan. Well, local governments in Japan have a long way to go to ensure people living on the remote islands have adequate support if any emergencies were to happen. According to Kingston, it is still unclear how such support local authorities would provide and or how much support, and also communication and transport links remained limited in Okinawa, which would in turn limit the effectiveness of any evacuation plans. So now let's look at some other things that are coming due with regard to this. Ukraine war provides insights for Japan's civilian protection. Other analysts add that it is very difficult to actually evacuate tens of thousands of people from remote islands once a military conflict breaks out. They argue that the only way to ensure the safe evacuation of civilians under these circumstances is if the warring parties reach some tacit agreement. From Ukraine's experiences, we know evacuating civilians is very hard to do during a war. And mass evacuations is even harder to execute, said Koichi Nagano, a political scientist in Sophia University in Japan. Both Kingston and Nakano point to Okinawa's brutal history during World War II. The island was the site of a battle between the United States Army and the Japanese forces in 1945, which killed more than 200,000 people. And with that in mind, many local governments and residents, rather, view the ongoing efforts and evacuation drills and with skepticism and concern. Many people feel there is, once again, preparation to use Okinawa as a buffer in a possible military confrontation, Kano told Deutsche Welle. Well, the government has no choice but to acknowledge that to a certain degree, Okinawa is less safe than it used to be, and that's why they have to conduct evacuation drills, but I don't think that they can really reassure the local people, he added. Well, tensions in the region were running especially high last summer when senior U.S. lawmaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. China saw the visit as implicit support to Taiwan's independence and responded by staging massive military drills, with several Chinese missiles reportedly landing in Japan's exclusive economic zone. Well, benefits of the Yanaguni Islands, where evacuation drills were held in December, told Japan's daily Yomiuri Shimbun that this incident made them realize the rising military threat from across the Taiwan Straits. Also in December, Japan revealed its biggest defense budget increase since World War II, aiming to raise the defense spending to 2% of gross domestic product and strengthen its counter spike capabilities. In its newly released national security strategy, Tokyo characterized China as the greatest strategic enemy ever to securing the peace and stability of Japan. It also highlighted the fact that Beijing hasn't ruled out the possibility of using force against Taiwan. Kingston from Temple University in Japan adds that issues related to Taiwan's insecurity have been baked into Japan's foreign policy, and there is longstanding sympathy and support for Taiwan in general. According to the expert, Tokyo's commitment to Taiwan will continue regardless of who is in power. Okay. Let's just see what else is going on here. One second. One moment here. Okay, let's see if we get this here. Okay, this also, this question is, why Netanyahu, the head of the Israeli government, paused the march of tyranny and nobody who loves Israel can rejoice yet? these are some of the major issues. So when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his key coalition allies on Monday morning that he saw no alternative other than to pause their legislative blitz maneuvering Israel's judiciary, the far-right Otzma Yehudit leader, Itamar Ben-Gvir, was reportedly the most bitterly opposed. "We are letting the anarchists win," protested Ben-Gvir, using the coalition leader, favored term for the defender of our democracy, according to an unconfirmed account of the conversation reported by Channel 12 News in Israel. One second. "We are letting," okay, so we're not letting them win, religious Zionist party chief Bezalel Smotrich is said to have retorted. We'll only hold the legislation for a few months. At which point, the Justice Minister, Yariv Levin, reportedly summed up, quote, "You're all correct, but we need to be smart. We'll pass the legislation later on, but not now. We have people in Likud who are opposed. I'm not sure that we'll have 61 votes in the 120-seat Knesset, which is the parliament. The people want reform, and they will get it. But we also have to look at what's going on outside with the anti-overhaul protests, etc. It can't be ignored." The exchange helps underline why, when Netanyahu told the nation on Monday evening that he was halting the legislation's progress for a few weeks, his declared readiness to do so, quote, "out of national responsibility, out of a desire to prevent a rift in the nation," end quote, was instantly dismissed as empty rhetoric by the leaders of the mass protest. And opposition leader Yair Lapid warned that Netanyahu might be up to his old tricks. After all, Levin had vowed repeatedly during the 3 months since he unveiled plans to give near absolute power to the coalition and leave Israelis' most basic rights unprotected, that his reforms, quote-unquote, would not be halted, quote, even for a minute, end quote, and reportedly threatened to resign should the march to enactment be interrupted. Furthermore, the Prime Minister had insisted as recently as last Thursday that while no disagreement should be allowed to endanger our joint future, a central element of his de-democratization assault, the law that gives the coalition control over the appointment of judges, would be approved by the Knesset this week as planned in its current form. What then prompted Netanyahu to magnanimously announce the temporary shelving of that law and the others in the pipeline on Monday evening and Levin to back him in the coalition meeting earlier in the day? Well, the simple fact, as the Justice Minister reportedly acknowledged, is that despite heading a 64-strong coalition in the 120-member Knesset, they were no longer certain that they had the votes for an absolute majority, not technically required to pass the judicial selection law, for which a simple majority would suffice, but a major asset in defending the democracy-shattering legislation before a still-functioning and independent high court. What had changed since last Thursday was that Netanyahu had fired his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, for having the temerity to privately and then publicly warn that the national divide over the coalition's bid to change the way Israel is governed was prompting deepening dissent in the ranks of the military to the point where it constituted a, quote, clear, immediate, and tangible threat to the security of the state, end quote. The dismissal of the defense minister on Sunday night in turn triggered a spontaneous national uprising, angry demonstrations that raged for hours among a growing swath of the citizenry who saw in Gallant's brutal determination further evidence that Netanyahu continued to place personal and political interests above the core needs of the state. And those protests, in turn, finally prompted a handful of Likud politicians to publicly raise concerns, not heaven forbid, but about the content of the Netanyahu-Levin legislation, but about the way it was being steamrolled through Parliament with a speed and brutality that opinion polls have indicated was gradually alienating even more of the public. Part of the likes of Nir Barkat, Yuli Edelstein, David Bitton, Eli Dalal, and Danny Danon no longer guaranteed the Gallant, and Gallant himself most unlikely to vote with the coalition, Levin was compelled to point out that I'm not sure we'd have 61. So that seems to be the issue. And we'll have to see where all this goes, because at the moment I'm just literally not sure where it will go. But so far it's like about a 30-day respite. And if anything, it may lull people to no longer demonstrate, but I really question if it will. So I think this will continue after the Passover holidays conclude. So we'll see where all that goes. Unbelievable. One second. One moment here. One second. This is frightening. Two have died in a knife attack at an Islamic center in Lisbon, and an assailant was shot by police. An attacker armed with a knife, two women on Tuesday at an Islamic center in the Portuguese capital of Lisbon before being shot and wounded by police authorities, had said. Officers were called to the center just before 11 o'clock in the morning, where they encountered a man armed with a large knife, a police statement said. Quote, orders were given to the attacker to cease the attack, which he disobeyed, advancing towards the police, knife in hand, it added. Faced with a serious and ongoing threat, the policeman used firearms against the person, hitting and neutralizing the aggressor. Armed police wearing bulletproof vests stood outside the entrance of the Ismaili Muslim Center, located in a landscaped park in northern Lisbon. Prime Minister Antonio Costa said it was, quote, premature to make any interpretation of this criminal act, end quote. Continuing, end quote, everything points to this being an isolated incident, he told reporters. While police actually said there were several wounded, the head of Portugal's Ismaili community, Rahim Firozali, said one person was hurt in addition to the two women who were killed. The armed man attacked three people who were in the Ismaili center, killing two of them and injuring a third, he said in a statement. The motives of the attacker are not known, he added. It's a crisis there. Very, very frightening, to say the least. And this is really fascinating. I don't know if they could do that here in the United States, but there you never know. French financial prosecutors are searching a bank offices over a dividend stripping. French authorities today reached offices of several large banks, including Société Générale, Banque Nationale Paribas, and HSBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, on the suspicion of money laundering and fiscal fraud. A spokesperson of the PNF Financial Prosecution Office told Reuters. Société Générale confirmed the searches. The others concerned banks could not immediately be reached for comment. The spokesperson confirmed earlier reports by the newspaper Le Monde, The World, which said that the probe was linked to dividend stripping and also hit Exxon and Natixis. The PNF said that five investigations were ongoing, are linked to the so-called cum-cum practices, through which wealthy clients sought to evade taxes on dividends through complex legal structures. The ongoing operations, which have required several months of preparation, are being carried out by the 16 investigative judges and over 150 investigation agents, the PNF said in a statement issued around midday on Tuesday. So we'll learn a lot more about this by tomorrow. And this is fascinating. It seems that Credit Suisse has settled a French tax fraud probe for 238 million euros. Credit Suisse settled a tax fraud and money laundering case in France on Monday with a 238 million euro, that's a $234 million payment, to the state, putting another legal headache behind it as it reaches or it readies to unveil a tragic and strategic overhaul. Okay, so that's the story there. And so we've accomplished something in that realm. Bear with me a second. And I think that'll be it. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. It'll be another day. And until then, I just wish you a goodbye and a good day.